Well, that's so 70s, isn't it? Sweet Comfort Band and Good Feeling. And it is 12 and a half minutes after the hour. It's a Tuesday morning. And joining us now from Garden Valley, Texas, Dr. Don Clark. Don is a biochemist and a member of the Board of Creation Moments. And Don delights us with his conversation. Every Tuesday morning, we talk about science and faith and evolution and creation and such things, just about anything that has to do with science, even remotely. Huh, Don?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We can certainly go off on rabbit trails from time to time.
We've been known to do that.
Sometimes those rabbit trails are actually interesting.
They are, and we've learned a lot. I'm just thinking of the record of conversation. We've got now, 5 years of conversations with you in the podcast archives. And so anybody that wants to learn something can go up there and click on Dr. Don Clark's name, and then you'll see all those things listed chronologically, the most recent at the top of the page. You can select one, listen to it, download it, share it. And most of these conversations take about a half an hour, so it's good stuff. You learn a lot. And there's a new question. We've never tackled this one before, Don. This is brand new. I'm not quite sure how to handle it here. There's some articles out there, one of which is on the Smithsonian, and it questions how big land animals can actually get, that there are somehow limits here, and that it's imposed by physics. Would you agree with that? Can an animal be too big? What's the biggest animal on Earth now? And we keep thinking of, remember the dinosaurs from a long time ago, and think that maybe somewhere there are mysterious animals that we haven't seen. They might be, there's fables that they're in the middle of the earth, and they come out at the poles, and they're just somewhere. We just don't know where. We haven't seen like Bigfoot and things like that. Are there huge animals around? What's the biggest animal?
Well, the biggest land mammal, obviously, is the elephant, mm-hmm. The African elephant, which stands at about 13 feet. Mm-hmm. If you're talking about animals in general, then the blue whale is the largest sea animal. So, but there was a time, of course, when dinosaurs roamed the earth. And those got extremely large. So something obviously happened between then and now. But I guess this whole interest in the size of mammals in particular kind of came about through a new movie, which is out, which is a remake of the old Kong movie.
I think it's a remake of the remake, because I remember being scared to death in the 1950s. I used to. That's when they brought out the 1933 King Kong movie again, and they were promoting it on TV, and watching those promos just upset me when I was 4 or 5 years old. I said, oh, that's scary. That's scary stuff.
You were a dainty
But guy. Somehow King Kong has gotten even bigger through the years, hasn't he?
Oh, yeah, he keeps growing, mm-hmm. He's lives on Skull Island, and so the latest movie, has him, at least 100 feet tall and weighing in at 158 tons. Now, the question, at least the question of this article that we're addressing here today, is can a mammal be that big? Mm-hmm. Can a mammal get that big, even if conditions were absolutely perfect, on Earth for growing large things? And there's a mathematical problem that one runs into, because as the mass of the animal, for example, would increase cubically, whereas the surface area or the height of the animal only increases by the square. So the taller you get, the more mass you have, which means it's not in direct proportion to your height, but it's a cube versus square type of thing. So if you double in height, then you've increased your mass by a power of 8. And so your bones won't be able to support the mass at a certain point. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't be able to get to that large.
Let me see if I can put it in different terms. I'm trying to grasp this thing now. The volume increases in opposition to the surface area. In other words, creates a tension. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Mm. Yes. So, for example, if you... you would think that, oh, you know, we just increase everything proportionally.
Mm-hmm.
Everything will be fine because, you know, if you increase your height by, like I said, as a factor of two, then your bones are going to increase by a factor of two, not only lengthwise, but in diameter, and everybody will be happy. But what actually takes place is if you double the height, then your internal mass, for example, or it goes up by another factor of 10 over that.
You've mentioned this as a mathematical principle, and I'm trying to compare it to something else. If you put too much air in a balloon, you huff and you puff and you blow and you blow and you blow, it'll pop. I mean, there's a limit.
It will. Yeah, it will pop. And you know, obviously, you will, physically, you won't be able to sustain the increase in volume, if you will, or mass on the inside because of the, because of your height. So there is a physical, physical limit as to how tall or how big can mammals get. Now, when you're talking about sea creatures, we got a different situation because they've got buoyancy in the water. So you can have a very massive whale, as the case, as we do with the blue whale, and it could be it can grow to be quite a large creature, and the interestingly, amphibians like the dinosaurs and lizards, they continue to grow as long as there is food around to feed them, which is another issue. Is the obviously the bigger you grow, the more food you need. And it's also is a problem for King Kong because the little island that he was on couldn't possibly produce enough food, for him, being that that large.
That's what made him cranky, apparently.
Yeah, and so, he didn't like his island being disturbed by helicopters and various other things. And especially, the bombs that they were shooting down at the island, and so he wouldn't be able to have enough food, and we ask about we don't ask, but I mean the whole thing about what happened to the dinosaurs, they were huge, huge creatures. And at least some of them were. Of course, some of them were very tiny creatures, but some of them were huge. How could they have survived? And where did they get their food? If the larger the animal, the more food you need, obviously. One of the answers to that question is that they lived in a more perfect environment than what we live in today. And that, obviously brings us back to the great transition on the surface of the Earth and the great remodeling of the Earth at the time of the flood. And so, the evidence that we see, the evidences that we see for, dinosaurs and the dinosaur bones and the larger creatures, even turkeys were bigger back then, was that the conditions on Earth were more perfect for life. Mm-hmm. And a matter of fact, before the fall, God said that after he created man, he said that it was very good. And so the word there for very good is that it was perfect. His pinnacle of creation was man on earth, and everything that he created was perfect. So the environment was perfect. The the solar system, the space, and everything, the stars and everything were in their place, in the perfect position that they needed to be in order to support life to its fullest here on Earth. But of course, that started to change when man fell out of grace and disobeyed God, and ultimately it changed at the time of the flood, when the whole surface of the earth, completely got redone by massive amounts of water, not only from the sky, but from the deep, as we had talked about before, and the major, massive tidal waves that swept across the earth, and of course the breaking up of the landmass in, Pangaea into the current continents that we have today. So, we don't see, the dinosaurs didn't die off by a giant meteorite, as is popularly claimed. And in fact, one would, we read from the history book of Genesis that all land mammals, all land animals, I should say, were on the ark. At least, two by two, there were a pair of them. So all the different types of the dinosaurs would have been on the ark, and certainly could have survived through the flood, and then, started to get dispersed after the flood. Now, if the environment isn't as perfect after the flood, then you wouldn't anticipate that the dinosaurs would get as large as they did before the flood. And indeed, that's what we, would find. And looking for massive animals post-flood, we wouldn't necessarily expect that. Mm-hmm. Including man.
And we may have been much less aware, I suppose, of the huge seafaring animals, though. Those that travel the oceans out in the middle and at deeper levels. I mean, the giant things that even exist today were, I suspect, largely unknown back in that time.
Well, yes. Except for possibly the plesiosaur, which is mentioned in Job. Mm-hmm. Did they have, was there a lot of boats that they went traveling on the seas, high seas at that time? We have no evidence of that. We have no evidence that they didn't have the ability to make boats either. But, man was living kind of on the center of this large continent called Pangaea. And, probably didn't have a whole lot of awareness of massive water that would have been, Atlantic and Pacific Oceans as we kind of know them today.
Unless listeners are thinking this is a fairy tale, no, because both secular and Bible-believing scientists understand and agree that there was a single continent, a landmass, called, and they called it Pangaea, that eventually broke up into the continents we see today. They differ as to when and how that happened, but agree that such was the case. There's common ground we could start from right there and look at evidence of how the Earth has changed over the years. There's another article I'm looking at now that is asking about climate change and could it cause humans and animals to shrink? And it's making the point here, or trying to make the point, that mammals became smaller because of global warming a long time ago. They're saying 54 million years ago. In fact, twice over history, they claim records, recorded instances of animals shrinking. For example, horses got 14% smaller. They were about 17 pounds, so they were little bitty horses back then, and shrunk to, I don't know how they can determine this in this day and age, but to like 14 pounds. And now they're speculating that if there's global warming going on now, humans could become smaller. That has not been the trend over the years, has it? I mean, we human beings have gotten generally larger, and is that strictly due to diet and health, or is there some other reason? Climate reasons, maybe.
Oh, yeah, I don't know if the climate has changed, you know, that that much to affect us, you know, more or less. I think the problem, one of the problems, obviously, is that, or at least in that analysis, is that we have more knowledge about things that we eat, and so therefore, you know, probably our diets in general are better. And so that, and our lifespans are longer than they were. You know, somebody in the 1800s who was probably 40 or 50 was reaching the end of their life if they even lived that long.
And I have read and heard, in fact, Doug Greenwald has talked about this a number of times on our Wednesday discussions, that the average man back in first century Israel was about 5'2". That was the average height. And lived to the early 40s. So, and then now, and how does this change your picture of Jesus? Let's imagine a man that's about 5'2". And he's 30 years old, and really at the peak of his powers then. And he's a relatively, that's like middle-aged man, if you live typically into your 40s. And, right. And that would be because, I don't know if that's genetic, or if simply life was harder then. There were more causes of death from disease and violence and so forth than there are now. So that you, typically, on average, because when you say average, it encompasses a lot of reasons, a lot of rationales for people to die. You simply didn't live as long because it was dangerous and it was a hard life. Is that accurate?
Oh, I think so. I think it was a very hard life, obviously. And you know, there were wars going on constantly. One group of people battling another group of people, and the Romans had conquered, at Jesus' time, had conquered most of the known world by that time. But even them, they were constantly being on the you know, on the front lines, if you will, constantly being challenged by the people that lived there because they didn't want the Roman occupation, and so all of these things you know, contributed to folks not living a long time, environments not necessarily from an environmental factor, but just from, as you said, from diseases, from, you know, lack of knowledge of cleanliness, water supplies being, you know, contaminated because, again, not having the knowledge that, hey, maybe we should try to keep our water clean as opposed to washing everything and you know, defecating in the water that we were actually drinking. And so I'm sure, you know, parasites were, you know, a big problem in those type of things in reduced life. But, you know, when you go back in the history book, when you go back in the Genesis, you learn that, oh my goodness, you know, before the flood, man's average lifespan was 900 years. So going from 40 years to 900 years, what in the world is different? Is it a genetic problem that we face today? In a sense, well, yes, after man fell, I mean, there was a genetic problem, but even the 900 years, there was a lot of time from man's fall to, you know, the ultimate flood. But it just goes to show you that the environment in which man lived before the flood was a lot better, you know, for us than after the flood. But even after the flood, you know, we had Noah who lived a very, very long time. And then his immediate descendants lived quite a long time until the age, by the time you get to Moses, the age is has now dropped to 120, and you know, then from 120, we read later that, you know, your lifespan is 70. And if you're a righteous man, then it'll be 80. So, you know, how do we go from 70 to 80, that down to 40, now back up to 70 and 80?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
good question.
It all has to do with the perhaps loss of knowledge of cleanliness, if you will, because you know, the Jewish nation was taught that it's not good to eat this, it's mm-hmm. not good to eat that. You know, it's good to eat this. You have to treat your food like this. You have to wash your hands and mm-hmm. wash your feet. You know, and so they were taught cleanliness. They were taught that, you know, how to treat how to take care of the water supply so that it is clean and pure. And although a lot of this was religious rituals, you know, God was preparing the nation to receive the Messiah, obviously, there was a benefit to them to obey God's laws in that way. And with like I said, the food that they ate and the way the cleanliness that came out of the Levitical, you know, ultimately the Levitical laws by which they lived. Even when we get to Nebuchadnezzar and Shadrach and Abednego, you know, when these three boys, you know, come into Babylon and are treated like everybody else, they said, "No, no,
we're not going to eat. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're not going to eat your food. We want to be allowed to eat our food." And we'll, you know, if you allow us to do that, we'll show you that we're going to be stronger and healthier by eating our food as opposed to your food.
You know, that alone, all by itself, is something I've seldom considered in my Bible study, is why that difference. But it says a lot about the Hebrew culture versus the Babylonian culture. And it leads me to believe that you know, well, I there had to be a lot of other stories going on around the world in other cultures at that time, but the one we know the most about is the Hebrew culture, because it was written down. And the most prevalent writing we have is the Bible, the source for so much of this information, so much of this knowledge, so much of what distinguishes the Hebrew culture from the rest of the world. Do you know of other ancient documents that address culturally the things that the Bible did?
Oh, I'm not necessarily aware of that. Now, we know that the Chinese obviously you know, wrote a lot of stuff down as well. Interestingly enough, they have flood stories in their legend, mm-hmm. and they have flood stories in their own writing, mm-hmm. in the caricatures of their own writing.
But
so,
I think what I'm asking about, though, is a record of day-to-day life and the laws, and there are so few ancient written codes. You think of Hammurabi and some of those, but those are predate the Hebrew culture I'm talking about. But moral law, I'm not sure there's much of that around, except in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's where the civilization, you know, started. I don't mm-hmm. think there would be any argument there, even from a secular world, that the civilization started in the Middle East. And of course, we've got, as you said, the documentation from Scripture that points everything to the Middle East as not only the start of civilization, but the start of all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then people got dispersed from the Tower of Babel, obviously from Babylon, and started their journey to start to populate the rest of the world. And you wonder if they, because the languages were confused at the tower, did they somehow lose the ability to write things down? And perhaps, you know, and I'm not an expert in this field by any means, you know, perhaps that indeed was the case. Because if you got your language automatically changed, it's like you're going to have to start all over again and figuring out, okay, well, how do I write that sound down? Because if you were used to writing something, you know, down in a different language, and all of a sudden you don't have that language anymore, mm-hmm. that would be a confusing thing in it.
Still a challenge today. You can talk to people like the Seed Company, who writes translations in the 6,000 or 7,000 different languages now, and they're still discovering new languages that do not have an alphabet, are not written languages. There's still a few of those around, and it takes centuries to develop. David, was that you?
It was me. No. I thought I saw a pause there, and I thought I'd jump in.
I'll take a breath.
Okay. or a nap.
Yeah.
I've often thought about the Tower of Babel story, and I'm wondering if it's possible that the real core of the story is not language, and that the real core of the story is a kind of not a euphemism, but symbolism,
allegory
of something, possibly an allegory, possibly for something else that was going on that created, they created advantages, biological advantages, for the chosen people, and the rest of the enemies, the less righteous, were given, I don't know, genetic diseases or something that they would die off. And I've never read this before. This is a brand new original thought. I just had it about 15 seconds ago.
Oh, you had to write that down. Write a book.
About a minute and a half ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess I'm trying to find something that will have as much import as the theory of devolution.
But, nothing that ranks with Dr. Don's theory of devolution, I tell you.
And I'm not sure that we're even going to get anywhere, but I'm just wondering if there is not something more common, more concrete, more exact, as opposed to people couldn't understand each other anymore because...
Well, how about this? We've talked about epigenetics here many times.
Sure.
And if we take it as the literal truth that there were all these people congregated in the Middle East, and then they got dispersed, they went to different regions of the world, and their body, that is to their bodies, their physical bodies, that is to say, genetically over time, created minor variations that allowed them to adapt to those climates and to those food sources and to those cultural conditions that they made for themselves in those areas. So there was a differentiation of people even beyond language. But I can see where the language might have been the catalyst that caused them to distribute themselves over the face of the earth. I mean, if you're in a place where you can't communicate, you will naturally gravitate to a place where you can.
And you're going to gravitate with people that can speak your same language.
Mm-hmm. So the folks that speak the same language you do. I'm just... Huh? Yeah, so
I mean, if we're going to talk about the Tower of Babel, we got to talk about the reason for the dispersion in the first place.
Okay.
And God kept telling people that be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. That was the commandment that he gave to Adam and Eve, to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And he gave that commandment to Noah and his sons, even after, after the flood and after they came out of the ark, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And so people start, descendants start gathering in the plain of Shinar. And this this one dude called Nimrod wanted to be, interestingly enough, worshipped, and he was a hunter. But if you understand what his character was, he was a hunter of men.
Hmm.
In that he was turning the hearts of men away from God and to himself. to be worshipped, much like, obviously, the serpent did in the garden, and the desire of Lucifer, later called Satan, that was his desire. So he had the Antichrist spirit to draw men to himself, as opposed to pointing them, to God. That was the crime. That was the essence of what was happening at Babel, and God then confused their languages as a means of really, if you look at it from a spiritual point of view, as an act of mercy upon mankind. Because hadn't they had their languages confused, most of man would have been, again, turned towards the enemy's cap, and then God would have had to destroy them yet again. And so in order to delay that process, if you will, he broke up the land masses. He dispersed the people. They weren't doing it in quote willingly, because they liked gathering and together.
Touch on the time frame too, will you? Because there was the flood, there was Noah and the survivors, and as I recall, the Tower of Babel was an event about 600 years post flood.
Yes, and the people were gathering. Hadn't dispersed. Mm-hmm. Upon the earth,
and this is within a span of a lifetime. We should make that point also, because Noah was still around.
Yeah, he lived 900 years. Mm-hmm. So he was 500 years at the time of the flood. He lived another 400 years. So he was the patriarch. He was the oldest dude, mm-hmm. Around. Yeah. At the time, and he was still preaching, I am sure. Because he had seen the evil that was on the earth before the flood, and so also his sons. But it was, it was the righteous line of Noah's descendants that ultimately became the Israelites, if you will. Mm-hmm. But God had to take care of the situation, yet again. And the most gracious way of doing it was just to confuse their languages so that they couldn't live together. It wasn't a long time. People had, multiplied. That wasn't the problem. But the problem was that they weren't being dispersed or filling the earth. And so, evil was starting to crop up again in a big way under the leadership, if you will, of Nimrod. Mm-hmm.
So, David, there's your allegory. There's your allegory. Not so much the language change, but the tower itself. Mm-hmm. And whether it doesn't make any difference whether the tower was actually a tower, and historically I think they've agreed that it is and may have found remnants of it. But even if that was a pure literary allegory, the point is the same. It was allegorical, and it symbolized, it represented, might be a better word, man's hubris at that point.
And it represented man's rebellion against God, really, is what it represented. And because he was going to build for himself a tower which would reach up into heaven, for the purpose of becoming a god himself. And so when you read the story in that light, and you see the mercy of God and the grace of God being poured out on man and saying, we're not doing this again, especially so soon. Mm-hmm. We're going to disperse you whether you like it or not, and hence the confusion of the languages. And then, the people's, it maybe did it by family group. We don't really know, but, people began to migrate after that time. Now, it's interesting to note what is happening physically to the earth during this time. Well, immediately at the flood, in post-flood, we had the continents drifting apart. We had the glacier period, if you will, the ice age, taking place. So even though the land masses were moving apart, and all of this, volcanic activity, going on, it was probably safer for man to kind of stay in the Shinar area, in the landmass that wasn't being so disrupted, if you will, by everything else that was going on. But there came a time when it was fruitful for man to move now and to go into these other regions. And even the separation of the land masses allowed for the subsidence or the slowing of the evil, being propagated once the languages were confused and once people were dispersed. So even that is a is showing God's grace and mercy upon people. A physical thing like the land moving apart into the continents, because now you've got physical barriers between people groups that you didn't have before.
Interesting. It another, said, David, there.
Yeah, another.
It was either that, or it was Nimrod's tax policies.
It could be it.
Constantly,
which would have been very oppressive.
Yeah, it would have been.
I'm wondering too if a part of that was that. And, I'm thinking, and I'm not sure where I get this idea, but Grandpa and Great-Grandpa became agriculturists, and they were, developed societies in that location or where they happened to land, or, around where the boat came down. And Nimrod was a hunter and gatherer and was more mobile and perhaps took his people or his armies or whatever to a different place.
Now, my understanding is that agriculture began in the Middle East as well.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
And I could be wrong, but I think that's what even secular science has agreed to. Mm-hmm. And the ramifications of that are manifold. And yep, Don, no rabbit trails here, huh? We started talking about King Kong, and where are we now?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, my goodness. Well hopefully we've talked about the king a little bit. So.
Well, we did. We learned a few things.
I see a direct correlation. I see a very exact line from point to point to point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't see a problem.
It does make sense. It really does. Dr. Well, Don Clark, chairman of the board, not chairman, vice chairman of the board at Creation Moments.
One of the questions I have is, why would a town in Minnesota name themselves Nimrod?
That's a good idea.
I want to talk to the city founders. And of all names, why did you pick that name?
Well, Nimrod came to be a kind of a derisive term, too, didn't it? I mean,
in
our culture, it's like you're a dummy. Like you're a hick, like country bumpkin kind of thing. So.
Interesting, yes.
Yeah. Creation Moments, I want to point out their website to you, Don, being a board member there, and it's a wonderful website. Brand new one being developed, by the way, but you can still link there at brokenroadradio.com, and you'll find all kinds of good resources on the scientific support, evidence for the biblical creation story. I think you ought to go there to pay a visit and see what they have to offer, creationmoments.com. Don, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it. And we'll see you next Tuesday, okay?
Okay, very good. See you folks. Have a great week.
You too. Bye-bye.
See you, Don.